Yay.
Hi.
Thank you for coming. This is a good start.
Oh my god. Oh my god.
Words. All of the words just occurred in my mouth at the same time. Thanks for coming to Future Justice in the Present.
Yay.
I guess we're going to introduce ourselves one by one. I'm Nat Raha. I'll talk about myself more in a minute.
I'm Kachenga.
And I'm Jackie. This feels like a talk show. Or
I know. Like,
holy crap. Who's our guest today?
All I know is I'm not the father. But
yeah. We want this space to be as relaxed as possible. So if you need to like move around or if you want to get up or run out, please feel free. If you want to come and sit on these lovely cushions, if like halfway through you're like, yeah, I want to come and sit in the middle of the stage with the cushions, please do. It'd be really great because we wanted everyone to feel as close as you could be, you know, so that's as close as it gets.
So we have the memes running behind our heads. So just, we got to keep in mind if people just randomly start laughing, like, oh my God, this is so humiliating. What did I do? It's probably the meme that they're laughing. They're laughing with us, not at us.
So should we begin?
Yeah, let's.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll introduce myself. So yeah, I'm a writer. Spiritually, it came to me at the age of around 25, I guess. I just had this mantra in my head. I was working as a teaching assistant at the time, going through a lot of different things, and yeah, out of nowhere, this mantra, write or die, just write or you're gonna die, write or die, came into my head, so that began. But then it wasn't until I was 28 and I was in rehab for my addictions to various substances, and I was sober for the first time in 12 years, and the blinkers coming off meant that I could finally feel the pain in an unadulterated way, and writing helped me pull myself out of the well I'd fallen down, basically. At the beginning there were some names of some trans women of colour. I really wanted to bring them into the space, because one of them in particular, Janet Mock, her autobiography, I took with me to rehab, and it was the first time I had seen so much of my story reflected in the life of another woman. So it was huge. So I started writing like a beast, really, over the course of that 28 days. Yeah, now that I've been sober properly for 23 months and a couple of days, something like that, I am now writing professionally, mainly for online feminist media. Shout out goes to Galdem, who are the first people to publish my article. And then I started writing for Wear Your Voice, which is an online feminist magazine in the US. And I also have been writing a couple of things for Dazed recently, the first of which was a statement of support written by myself and Sean Fay, in support of Monroe Bergdorf. That's kind of, where I'm at right now in my life.
Cool. I'm Nat. I know lots of people in the room, so it's kind of nice. I decided a couple of days ago that I'm like the granddaughter of the Chittagong Uprising, which happened in Bengal in 1930. Bought the book. I'm a poet. I'm a queer and trans activist. I've been writing for I kind of really got into writing when I was 21. I kind of was involved in music, and it just kind of threw me in. I encountered experimental poetry one night. One fateful night. I guess I've just been thinking through different mediums, and we're gonna have a bit of a conversation about this, like thinking about writing. I'm also like trying to write a PhD on queer Marxism. And so there's the kind of academic writing, and then also trying to think much more about directly how to use writing prose kind of politically, how to put it out into the world in the most easily distributable forms, like also how to use that in like as part of like an economic redistribution model. So like how do you steal resources from people who are rich and then give money to people who are poor on the back of that? And it turns out that like when you're trying to boost the writing of other trans women and trans femmes, like most of us have no money. So that's like, it's quite an easy place to start in terms of being like, yeah, let's put our work together. Yeah, so I guess that's me. I've written a couple of books, some of poetry, and yeah, and.
Ooh, now I'm like, oh, this is the story of how we became writers.
You can break the story though if you want to.
Yeah, my name is Jackie Wang. I am a prison abolitionist, a poet, an academic, sort of. That identity feels weird. And writing for me was something that I always did compulsively. So I kept a diary since I was a kid. And then when I was like working at a grocery store as a teenager, I had access to a copy machine when the managers weren't around. So I'm like, I'm gonna make a perzine, which is a personal zine. And so I just like, I don't know, printed out my thoughts and copied and pasted them onto sheets of paper and made little booklets. And I'm like, hey guys, if you want to know my thoughts, here's my perzine. And I would also steal stamps, because in the zine world, stamps were a form of currency. So when I was working at the grocery store, I'd be like, I've got this perzine, I'll trade you some stamps and my zine for your zine. So that's how I became a writer, and now I guess I'm semi-institutionalized, it seems. But yeah, writing was always for me a way of making sense of the world, digesting subjective experience. So like, oh man, this thing happened, I really want to understand what it's about, so I need to take some time and write it out. So for me, I almost feel as though I'm not living when I'm not writing, that there's a way in which I'm only existing on the surface of things. So yeah, writing is just a mode of being in the world for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny listening to both of you talk that I begun to think about, yeah, where I come from, politically and culturally, and what I'm a child of. Quite literally, I'm the child of Pan-Africanist intellectuals. My mother's Jamaican and my dad's Zimbabwean, and they met in Brixton at the Brixton Law Centre working on the Scrap Sus campaign. And yes, so that was when the Met Police were able to just stop you on being about to commit a crime. Which is also like a Hollywood film. I'm sure that's like Minority Report or something. Is yeah, something like that. Yeah, as it goes. But yeah, it was like a lot less flash in early 80s London. So yeah, my parents spoke about Brixton at that time like really romantically. And my dad did the statistics. My mum was like the backbone of the administrative work for the campaign and stuff, because obviously the Met Police were using the SUS law, to lock up black and brown people predominantly. So fortunate that everything's changed. Anyway, so yeah, basically, I was very, I grew up around books and I grew up around language and around love. So I feel very much, for me, that I'm continuing that ancestral legacy, so becoming a prison abolitionist is just like a natural continuation of that work, which really became solidified for me when I became involved with Bent Bars, which is a prison pen pal service for LGBT prisoners, and we're always looking for pen pals, so please go to bentbars.org.uk and sign up if you've got a time to write someone on the inside. And so that's been really expansive for yeah, just teach me about a system which basically treats people as disposable, and the treatment of people behind bars not being something that we talk about enough, and how that space is gendered and how difficult it is for trans women on the inside. And politically, there's also a really strong link for me with the Black Lives Matter movement when we were doing a vigil for the International Day of Solidarity with trans prisoners. I was lovingly contacted by Black Lives Matter UK, who came along, and yeah, they just stood in support of me, and I felt really enriched by that experience. What was really funny for me was how much receiving the political support from these people watered my writing, and that, you know, when I speak to Black, brown, queer, trans people, there's such intense confidence issues, and I was really struggling with that. And it took me taking part in those spaces to be able to feel like I was worthy of sitting down at the desk and sharing my work. Is one thing, you know, just keeping everything and me, you know, getting that catharsis, but enough to have enough confidence to say that I am worthy enough, intelligent enough to share my work with others, has been huge for me. So yeah, that's the positive side. The negative side is that obviously because I'm a Black trans woman, sometimes I get contacted to write about like trans stuff, like in a really basic way. It's so boring. I'm so fucking tired. As it goes, and it's not writing about gender per se. It's always trans 101 stuff. It's always, I'm always being contacted, you know, oh, we really feel a trans woman of colour should write about this issue and stuff. And they are asking me to be a voice for my community, which, you know, it should be something that's positive, but really and truly, I'm always being asked to write the same thing. And I had this really weird experience of listening to Julia Serrano, The Whipping Girl. And like midway through, I was like, I say this stuff all the time. And it's like literally, you know, like 10, 12 years old now. But yeah, all right, guys. So saying that, I have written something recently about, yeah, the experience of being trans right now. So yeah, I'll take this off because I'm getting warm. Okay, guys, and I've shopped this around, so this is kind of, it's not out yet. So yeah, you're getting like a bit of a preview. As it goes. Yeah, and I try and sometimes, because when I'm writing about like serious stuff, I try and like throw in like song lyrics and stuff. So it starts with one from Whitney Houston. I believe the children are our future because they are the ones who validate me in the most gentle, mundane way in public space. The first time I used a woman's toilet, I was at the top of the Eiffel Tower. A comment from a friend under the selfie I took said, "Took you long enough." I had told some close friends, people in rehab and therapists, that I was trans over the course of the preceding year and a half. During this time, I had various incidents of men see me in the corridor of the gent and think that they had got the wrong door. An exasperated male staff member ran after me going into the men's changing rooms at the local pool. My gender presentation had been becoming steadily more androgynous, then violently feminine over the past 10 years. In secondary school, I was groped and beaten up at the same time. Concurrently popular for my charisma and bullied for my queerness, boys would ask my sister, "Why is Kachanga's bum so big?" A rhetorical question which classified my bodaciousness as a gross anomaly, as hormones confirmed their identities and wreaked havoc on mine. Since year three onwards, I was constantly being asked why I behaved like a girl. Children and adults alike saw my body and behavior as discordant. In truth, when I noticed myself being called a boy in nursery, a firm voice in my head said, "No, I'm not." But to say I was a girl, loudly and proudly, seemed dangerous, so I pretended. My father is Zimbabwean, my mother is Jamaican. Most of my family are Christian, many Jehovah's Witnesses. The landscape for living in one's truth was bleak. Reality was so binary. I prepared myself for homelessness after I was conditioned to expect relentless violence from my organic femininity in adolescence. Femininity always bubbled up from the deepest wells of my being. So it was that I did not meet my first trans woman until I met Emmanuel and Jamie at my homeless hostel when I was ejected from my family home at 17. They enticed me and also scared me shitless. No one respected their pronouns, and even the girls in our hostel that liked them saw them as aberrational jokes. I couldn't imagine living a life where people gave you such little respect. Transphobia puts plugs in your throat. You have no vocabulary for the visions of your true self that are both vivid and hazy. Repression curtains off parts of your mind, relegating the truth to the subconscious, where it becomes poisonously monstrous. My body was encased in a shell, and under the assignment of a gender that I just knew wasn't true. I did my best to try and get by, living as a cis gay guy, and almost killed myself in the attempt. Beginning to transition at the age of 28 after 25 years of pretense was a merciful act of self-love. Trans people loving ourselves is a scary thought to many. Using modern technologies, we have regained the identities and communities colonialists and missionaries did everything they could to erase. Two-spirit peoples in North Native America, Hijras in South Asia, the Mothe of Mexico. In these times where modern trans communities have found pockets of safety in which to bloom where possible and merely survive where it is not, I think of how glad Dr. Hirschfield must be that the spectrum of transgender expression is being celebrated. I have spent £15,000 thus far on surgeries to reverse the ravages of testosterone on my body. Estrogen and antiandrogens just make me feel so right. It's like for the most of my life I was driving a vintage car, listening to a radio station, where the music was great, but the reception was so bad it just gave you a headache. Now, this vintage car is purring like a beautiful Black Panther, and my melanated curves are glistening in the sunlight. Hormone treatment has made my body juicy as hell and my mental health super balanced. The more time passes, the more I am passing as cisgender. The sexual harassment in public is just as plentiful, but the sneers and titters I had got so used to over the years are decreasing. I feel at my most normal when shopping at Evans. As a size 16, skinny jeans with an elasticated waist are a godsend. To breezily pop into the changing room with no hassle is a blessing. I remember being turned away from female changing rooms in Topshop years ago, like Travis Alabanza, and skulking away in embarrassment. I don't have their courage. As an old school transsexual, I conform and do everything I can to not be seen as visibly trans. Others are not able to. Others do not want to. The privilege of passing as cisgender is not lost on me. As trans women, we whip each other into conformity. Those who get clocked as trans are seen as lazy, inattentive, and burdensome, letting the side down and keeping us from being accepted. We have grown up indoctrinated by cis conditioning that sees anyone that doesn't belong to the gender binary as, We have grown up indoctrinated by cis conditioning that sees anyone that doesn't belong to the gender binary camp as bizarre and worthy of their oppression. Non-binary and gender non-conforming people are seen as making a fuss and annoying in their insistence on gender neutral pronouns. Trans and cis people alike tell our siblings that the solution is to just become more like us. Shoddy transphobic think pieces, whether they be in the Times or the Sun, are endangering our lives. The memes that ask, what would you do if your son came home like this, are exhibits future generations will be shown when they ask why so many queer and trans kids are killed. At my lowest moments, I wonder what the media's endgame is. How violent will this backlash become? Are they going to come for our hormones and health services? The gatekeeping of medical establishments is arduous enough to deal with. Can my transness be legislated against? How many more siblings are we going to lose to their fear and hate? Which friend will I call to hide in their basement from rabid marching cisgender hordes bellowing, "You will not replace us"? I am wary of anyone who asks us to please think of the children. It's a dog whistle to the masses that we are getting too big for our boots. The connotation that we are dangerous to children and that the trans lobby won't be happy until surgeons swish into state schools with sanitized scalpels is too silly for words. Thatcher's government instituted Section 8 and promulgated the idea that the gay mafia sought to recruit youngsters. Yet now we see, a couple of decades later, that the biggest danger of the same-sex marriage has been to make lesbian, gay, bisexual people more happily boring. The nation's children are not in danger from trans people getting the love and support we need. Trans people are in danger of this nation. Virulent transphobia is the phenomenon that should scare us. The sexual assault, physical violence, and ostracization that destroys our lives deserve the headlines. The baby on the bus that stopped crying when I made a funny face had no problem seeing me as a human being. It's high time we followed that baby's lead and created conditions in our society for trans people to not just survive, but thrive. So yeah, I really don't want to have to write that sort of thing. It's not fun. It feels like a waste, you know. I'm being kept from writing creatively, which is where I really want to blossom. I did my creative writing course at the Open University, which was really liberating, but it's really hard for me to get any sort of work that fosters that. But the kind of work that I do like is that getting is, I have a great editor at Way Your Voice, Lara Witt.
For great editors.
Yes, yeah, she's incredible.
Anyone's ever written anything, their editors can be.
But I have a great relationship with her. It's really nice to I'm never told that I'm too much. I'm never told to tone it back. I'm never told that, you know, intersectional is too big a word. I'm just boosted. And I like, and that email relationship when she will just send me something that's occurred in the years and I had to write something really quickly, because normally I feel like really secure when I have to write something in my notepad and then transcribe it to the laptop. But this one I wrote recently about Rihanna and the Nefertiti cover that she did for Vogue Arabia. And I liked that one because I write for black women. Yeah, real talk. If I'm writing about popular culture, I don't like to have to think about like changing my vernacular that much. And this was, I just really enjoyed it. And also another thing is that I don't choose my headlines. My editor chooses them. And it's really funny because sometimes they'll be like quite Americanized. So it's not discordant, but yeah, the title to this one was, "If Rihanna wants to be styled as Nefertiti, y'all can keep your shady remarks in the trash where they belong." Which, yeah, it was just like really cute because, yeah, what follows is, I feel like, quite British in analysis. But anyway. People are reaching. When I first saw Rihanna's November cover for Vogue Arabia, I found her eye makeup mesmerizing. It's quite possible the makeup artist used her limited edition Galaxy eyeshadow palette, but I won't be able to find out until the queue for her products at Harvey Nichols in Knightsbridge goes down some. It's been snaking around the building for weeks. I have been wearing intense, well-blended blush on my temples since her look at this year's Met Gala left me edgeless once again. Her Fenty Beauty line is an asteroid that has given us 40 shades of foundation from the jump, and intergalactic glitters will have her stands gleaming from here to Pluto throughout the holiday season. Her impact on the beauty landscape has been seismic, and to call her a cultural phenomenon would be an understatement. She is shifting tectonic plates everywhere. The inspiration for the cover is Queen Nefertiti, an Egyptian queen who heralded a religious revolution. Her image, most specifically her profile, has been worn as a pendant by black women for decades. Growing up in the 90s with Pan-Africanist parents, I was made aware constantly that the history being taught in our schools was mythological in part. That enlightened humanity began with the lightly tanned Greeks was false. In Saturday schools run by black teachers, our history was given back to us. The Zulus, the great kingdom of Zimbabwe, the kingdom of Congo, the Mali Empire. They also told us the Egyptians were black. They pointed out paintings with pharaohs and goddesses with black skin and cornrows. Herodotus spoke of Egyptians having black skin and woolly hair. Erykah Badu wore ankhs and inspired a lot of us to investigate Egyptian spirituality further. Nas rapped about the Sphinx's nose being shot off because it was too evidently black. From a young age, we were being told that the whitewashing of ancient Egyptian history was a great big swindle. Our capacity to be great mathematicians, philosophers, artists, writers, and engineers was underscored with the reclamation of Egypt as part of African history. Nefertiti was a reclamation of ancient femininity. Selected because of her fine-featured poise, which is still problematic as it's not super disruptive to a Eurocentric depiction of womanhood. Nevertheless, to black peoples in the West with Hotep uncles, there has never been a question that she was black. I think Hoteps like her too because she's seen as traditionally submissive. She stood by her man as he took his peoples out into the desert to found a monotheistic religion with a god of his own creation, which is the summation of all their dreams. Ancient Egypt is a battleground of cultural warfare. White supremacists really want its history for themselves. From Elizabeth Taylor being cast as Cleopatra when the real Cleopatra was mixed. It's been proven with science. She was dusky, eh? To the flop that was the gods of Egypt casting the Nordic heartthrob, Nikolai Coster-Waldau, and Scottish leading man Gerard Butler as Aryan Egyptian gods. There is also a historical tendency to cast the slaves in films about ancient Egypt as black, which is telling. One wonders how Hollywood would cast a film about the Nubian takeover of Egypt in 800 BC by King Pui in 800, yeah. The Huffington Post finding random people on Twitter in order to say some people have a major problem with Rihanna's cover is sheer laziness. Discussions about cultural appropriation are complicated enough without people trying to lob curveballs to derail the discourse. Western people tend to have a difficulty mounting nuanced discussions of colonial history, semiotics, power dynamics, and cultural appropriation. Media that muddies that water is a low-key attempt to make black Twitter seem like rabid reactionaries who won't be satisfied until there is no art left. Rihanna has been guilty of cultural appropriation in the past, and this does deserve to be interrogated. Yet this time, instead of coming for someone who is expanding the representations of black femininity in the media, can we have another conversation? The fact that the colonization of the African diaspora had mental and physical components, see Franz Fanon, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, Sheikh Anta Diop. Ancestors who were enslaved had their bodies whipped for speaking indigenous languages. Spiritual practices of Obia and Voodoo and worshipping of Orishas could result in your death. In pre-colonial Africa, we traveled and traded, and those stories are now lost forever. Barbados was a slavery terminal where people from Benin, northern Ghana, Biafra, both settled and were re-exported to other parts of the Americas. Perhaps Rihanna's ancestors prayed to the West and went on the Hajj. Perhaps she is descended from Nefertiti, and this Vogue cover has some divine purpose. The truth is, because of the genocide that was the slave trade, we'll never know. For goodness sake, let us have our history as we envisage it to be. Thank you. Woo. So yeah, the reason I like writing things like that a bit more is that I'm able to, you know, just like wild out a bit and, you know, get colloquial and talk about history and hope for the future. And yeah, I really wish that I could write more stuff like that and have time to write the, yeah, wonderful mystical stories that are in my head and I don't have time to write right now. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
There's something between these, kind of like something that feels like a really important connection between what you're saying, Kachanga, about like not wanting to write the trans think piece and wanting to write these mystical stories. And like, Jackie, what you mentioned about like when you're not living, when you're not writing, it's like you're not living, that writing is a mode of being in the world. And I was thinking about this like relationship, like the importance of like having a world to write into, right? Mm-hmm. Like if we don't have, on the one hand, it's like these kind of pressures of what kind of writing people want from you, especially if you're a journalist, right? But I guess also in the academy, the same things happening, and also in like more kind of informal cultural spaces. But yeah, that actually, like, there's something about how do we blow open worlds in order for us to be able to write what we want to write. and like how, I mean, like this conversation as well is right, is about like, how do we bring our work into forms of dialogue? And then I guess it matches up to these histories of like, these like lineages we come as like diasporic people living in the countries of the colonizer, right? Like the nations that are literally like endangering us. Like how do we, like that's all the more reason of picking up our histories and trying to bring them back together in writing. Yeah, one thing that I guess in this, in thinking these things together, I've been thinking quite a lot about this kind of idea of like queer feminist diaspora and like how bringing our work together is a really important act. That sometimes, like, there's so many times where I've been like chatting to Jackie on Twitter or whatever, and just being like, oh, this thing's happening. And we very rarely end up in the same room, given the Atlantic's in the way. But then, and then obviously this room. But sometimes your work gets to exist in those spaces and live in those rooms, and like you're not there, but your writing is there, and you know, our work is next to each other, cover to cover, or whatever. And that feels really important. So I've been thinking a lot about that as a, like in relation to small press or DIY, like zining and self-publishing. So I put together this zine, which kind of came together from some political work, activist work, academic work, all at the same time, that a bunch of us were doing around under the umbrella of radical transfeminism, for those of you who can see. So like, in thinking about radical transfeminism, we were like, we're kind of really bored of this conversation about TERFs and about like where you collective grown. So we decided just to stop talking about that.
Yeah, and, please. And like, actually, and someone find them work.
So,
how do they have the time?
Yeah, so we started Radical Transfeminism, and like 3 years down the line, we produced it. We got to a zine. We went from like, let's have a conference, like, let's do all this stuff on no money. And yeah, and the idea was to like center the voices, but also not only the voices, like center our bodies, needs, experiences, our desires as like trans women or trans femmes and like non-binary trans feminine people in particular, but also like next to our like trans and non-binary siblings in general. And yeah, so I'm gonna just read a bit of the intro to this zine. So thinking about the centering to center our bodies, needs, experiences, and importantly our desires within our academic, activist, political, and organizing work. I read those in the wrong order. Our bodily autonomy is at the heart of this centering. So radical transfeminism entails a political analysis of our lives and experiences, getting to the root of them, and developing a life praxis that works towards social transformation, often on a small scale, with an ethos of mutual aid and solidarity with coalitional struggles. And then it should be really clear that to center transfeminine people is to center us as poor transfeminine people, as transfeminine people of color, as queer transfeminine people, as migrant transfeminine people, as disabled and or mad, with a capital M, transfeminine people, as transfeminine people who've been incarcerated in prisons, in hospitals, or otherwise. And like at the core of this is like this thing that we've been dreaming for decades of forms of radical social transformation rooted in black radicalism, anarcho-communism, gay liberationist and other collectivist politics. We've been necessarily working towards alternatives to capitalism and practicing them on a micro level when we can steal the hours to do so. Our feminism has emerged through the experiences of our lives transgressing gender norms that are always racialized, classed, and abled, through challenging the gender identity police, the psychiatrists, and the bourgeois politics of trans and queer liberalisms, through imbibing feminist writings and the writings of women and men of color, of queer and trans writers, pulling a transfeminist her story out of obscurity. So this is not just about the inclusion of trans people into feminism or of trans bodies into feminism. Radical transfeminism is about centering our bodies, experiences, knowledges, desires, and actions within a heterogeneous, decolonizing, anti-capitalist feminist project, rooting us as key actors within such a project, working with us and valorizing our labor, experiences, and our bodies and desires. So I really wanted to think through these questions of like, so if we're rooting a feminist practice in transfeminine bodies, what does this open up as a horizon of politics? What is needed to expand and develop our bodily autonomy? What practices must we put forward, social, sexual, in healthcare, in living? What conversations must be broached? What work must be undertaken to make our lives richer, to create the ground and conditions under which we can thrive? So what social transformation must we fabricate and fight for? It isn't just about ending capitalism in its current neoliberal forms, but obviously we wanted that, there's that too. What forms of collective power can we harness? What kind of living do we need to make possible? What inhabitations of our own bodies are possible in a better context, and how do we create that context? What kind of caring labor is needed to build upon the current situation of our bare lives and limited sustenance? How do we cut through the violence and shit of contemporary racial capitalism to fully automate a better, dykier, feminist, diasporic communism? That's good stuff. That the left is currently dreaming of. How do we deepen the particulars that make up radical transfeminism? It involves more than dilators, but then those two, and plenty of lube. I'm going to read, so I've been kind of thinking about this question, these questions around like transfeminism and transmisogyny. I wrote this essay that's in this journal, it's a South Atlantic Quarterly, called Transfeminine Brokenness, Radical Transfeminism. And in it, I was trying to think through this like question about like how these like questions we often think of social, as social issues, how they connect up to like the big structural issues around capitalism or how capitalism is structured. And I also used to live in London. This is kind of related, maybe. Is it related, Nat? Is it related? From my window, I could just see like Canary Wharf. My desk looked out into Canary Wharf. And so just like having this like, these like archetypes of financial capitalism in this like post 2008 crisis era are like literally like blinking at me when I'm trying to write my PhD or edit my poems. Just like, It feels like this connection is often missing, and it's when people think about the social issues facing trans people, quite often we don't think about how it turns into these structural issues very quickly, and that they manifest in like in relation to like needing housing, needing a job, like needing better healthcare, all this kind of stuff. And next to that is these kind of like how like the everydayness of it, which I guess is partly what Katenga has been talking about as well. So I'm just going to read this. It's called, the section of the essay is called Separation of Transfeminine Bodies and Work. When the lack of air cuts the thought that does not refract through another body. On the other side of the Western world, I meet a poet. Our conversation tends to a story either of us could have told with different colleagues or collaborators, different geographies, different queer and trans scenes, different bodies of different shifts through land and location. We drop off mailing lists and are absent from the spaces we've helped create and organize. The ideas and critiques we voice do not carry. The disqualification of our knowledge, of suggestions, of creating the time for our involvement, of our work within forms of queer and trans community and cultural spaces as trans femmes or trans women or constellating near these descriptions are the same. We call this phenomena textbook transmisogyny. But I also think of how Susan Stryker connects the disavowal of our knowledge rooted in an understanding of transfeminine bodies as anti-normative bodies to a, quote, more fundamental and culturally pervasive disavowal of intrinsically diverse modes of bodily being as the lived ground of all knowing and of all knowledge production, end quote. Stryker argues that consequently, the knowledge of how anti-normative bodies are materially affected, of how such material effects transform knowledge, are delegitimated as merely subjective, which, quote, circumscribes the radical potential of that knowledge in critique as feminism, communities of color, and third world voices have long maintained, end quote. So between the designation of the experiences rooted in transfeminine bodies as merely subjective and the disavowal of transfeminine knowledge as a site of knowledge in its multiplicities, the potential of our thought, and one might add our work, are circumscribed. To, at best, be bearers of civil rights and socially or micropolitically disqualified as bearers of knowledge is nothing new. It's nothing new for trans femmes, as it is nothing new for people of color, as it is nothing new for women, So it's nothing new for migrants, as it is nothing new for people with disabilities, as it is nothing new for intersex people of various genders. The difference is when we're organizing with fellow queers, fellow trans people, fellow feminists, fellow disabled people. Sometimes we hold up the moments when we all get the issue. One person points to it as us all getting the issue that maybe next time only two people in the room will get. But the structure is such that sometimes we're not even in the room, brackets, when there are no trans femmes at your party, or near the politics, brackets, when there are no trans women in your feminist community. The disavowal of knowledge of trans women and trans femmes, as Stryker suggests, as well as the exclusion of our bodies and the disregarding of the work we undertake, materially and psychically affects those denied and granted access to those rooms. This is the separation of our bodies and work and lives from queer, feminist, and trans world-making projects, which itself is the basic fracturing of such worlds, and the erasure of the poor trans femmes, often of color, who've inaugurated them. So of the names now known and held up as inaugurating the queer worlds, Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, Miss Major. Sometimes we witness a really beautiful spectacle of queer slash feminist slash of color community holding up its sisters and siblings, only to be reminded again of our deviance through exclusion. The psychic and emotional impact of this is sometimes too hard to bear, yet alone to begin speaking of. Sometimes we're either broken or not too broken such that we can begin to speak to each other as trans siblings, as queer sisters, among ourselves, or to build solidarity across these lines and build the moment of recognition that something historically specific kept us absent from whatever room it was this or that month. Sometimes this knowledge cascades into and through our interiors, into accumulating collective communal bodies. Sometimes it does not even begin to cohere this way. Sometimes it does not materialize. So that's that essay. And before I pass it on to Jackie, passing the mantle, I'm gonna read some poems from, I guess one of the things that is maybe coming up through the memes is this, like,
yay.
I guess, yes, that's us, we made it. And one of the things that I've been kind of doing, I guess the past year, I've been involved in Edinburgh Action for Trans Health. We've kind of have been messing shit up, I guess, in trans activism. That's our goal. We've also just been doing like really basic like community support in Edinburgh, like supporting trans people. The situation around trans healthcare in Edinburgh is a bit of a mess at the moment. The gender identity clinic doesn't have a doctor, lol. not a joke. Nobody's been seen for like 7 months. And in the meantime, Edinburgh Action for Trans Health produces manifesto. Which is, the manifesto's out there. I'm guessing have people in the room read the Edinburgh Trans Action for Trans Health manifesto? General, like, show of hands. We can maybe talk a bit about
it. It's on Tumblr.
Yes, some people. Yeah, it's on Tumblr. It's out there. It's in the scene. And there seems to be this tendency of like, it's become a tendency, right? I mean, maybe specifically in terms of like getting radical trans women who turn into like radical leftist Antifa. There seems to be like a thing that has emerged quite heavily in the past couple of years. I think there's much more broad historical tendency about like fed up femmes and women like being like, fuck this shit. Anyway, here's some poems. Bitter days in the crushing. I'm gonna stop. Bitter days in the crushing, flat national economies, supra nation drain the arrogance ruling class gagging up hills, the cities we disappear into, stores and spires weigh lumber, our absent scatter of poets, an imaginary they bury a bitter good, hope the song reaches and soothes you the downer hour, lost work and machines, in minutes these emptying atoms. For what we may be, the left from a future torched, working to deeper life. We lost girls, broken femmes, deviant, aching spines and flesh, built on the shuttered mouths of rape apologists, vibrantly storms but does not just march, or fed a collective support of all possible skins, builds conceptions and homelines to under common post, pining the fresh governance of recognition, a siren clawing up the street, teaches a fuck the police through all action feels beyond the future. Ruling Fascist store for us, closed eyes closed on its corpses, present in tonight's dreams. The dead left do not want us to love as much as this. We, anxious girls, slept debt, certain siblings, on call to the street. Bandages, we gossiped, kissed through our repressions, abet vicious nights, and urgent existence fleets into and out of these burning days. Thanks. Woo!
Okay, I'm gonna stand because I can only read while standing, it turns out. So I just finished a book that's coming out in January called Carceral Capitalism. It's on prisons, police, and racial capitalism, and there's a lot of essays about political economy and predatory fine farming by the police and municipal finance. And I wanted to end with poetry because they're just nonfiction essays. And my publisher, Semiotext, was like, yeah, that's fine. You can just have your collection of essays and end with poetry. Like, okay, cool. So there's this project that maybe one day I'll write it. I have all these shadow projects that I'm like, okay, I'm going to do my dissertation on this or my Semiotext book on this. And then I end up doing something completely different. But this project that I've been wanting to do for a while is on the prison abolitionist imagination. So I'm really interested in developing a prison abolitionist or abolitionist, also including police as well, poetics, and using poetry as not only a form, not only, you know, words in verse, but also a poetic mode of thinking as a way to undo the prison, as a way to displace the prison through the re-enchantment of the world. And this project was inspired by Robin Kelly, who wrote a book called Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. He was one of the main inspirations. So I didn't write a book on the prison abolitionist imagination, but it is the conclusion of my book, Carceral Capitalism. So I'm gonna read a few excerpts from the conclusion. And, you know, prisons, thinking about prisons is not just something that, you know, was topical because I'm from the United States. We are the largest per capita incarcerator in the world. I mean, that is something that has been on my mind, but my brother went to prison when I was 16 and he was 17. He got a juvenile life without parole sentence. The United States is also singular in the world for having mandatory juvenile life without parole sentences. Even before this happened, I would read Angela Davis, but this is also a piece of my commitment to prison abolition. Okay, so I will read a few excerpts from The Prison Abolitionist Imagination. The late Mark Fisher once famously said that it is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. The same could be said about prisons. It is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine a world without prisons. And yet the modern prison as it currently exists in the US is a fairly recent invention. Florida, which now has one of the largest prison systems in the US, had no physical penitentiaries at the end of the Civil War and had to create its penal system from scratch. Yet at this historical juncture, prisons have become thoroughly naturalized. Imagining and working towards a world without prisons, which is the project of prison abolition, would not only require us to fundamentally rethink the role of the state in society, but it would also require us to work towards the total transformation of all social relations. A project as lofty as this is easy to dismiss as unrealistic, utopian, impractical, naive, and unrealizable dream. But what if, instead of reacting to these charges with counter-arguments that persuasively demonstrate that the abolitionist position is the only sensible position, we instead strategically used these charges as a point of departure to show how the prison itself is a problem for thought that can only be unthought using a mode of thinking that does not capitulate to the realism of the present? Can the re-enchantment of the world be an instrument that we use to shatter the realism of the prison? What follows is a series of questions, conversations with revolutionaries, dead and alive, on death, dreams, the struggle, and the phenomenological experience of freedom. There are moments I want to enter. Will you follow me there, to the place where the breathing walls quietly exhale a low freedom song? One, the prison is our shadow. In a hypothetical conversation with his jailer, Darwish, a Palestinian poet, writes, quote, "You, not I, are the loser. He who lives on depriving others of light drowns in the darkness of his own shadow. You will never be free of me unless my freedom is generous to a fault. Then it would teach you peace and guide you home. You, not I, are afraid of what the cell is doing to me. You who guard my sleep, dream, and a delirium mind with signs. I have the vision and you have the tower, the heavy keychain and a gun trained on a ghost. I have sleepiness with its silky touch and essence. You have to stay up watching over me, lest sleepiness take the weapon from your hand before your eyes can see it. Dreaming is my profession, while yours is pointless eavesdropping on an unfriendly conversation between my freedom and me." End quote. The poet prisoner haunts the guard, who becomes a prisoner of his paranoia. The profession of the poet is dreaming. The profession of the jailer is to contain. The poet is the one who makes the light. The guard is the one who takes it. He who lives on depriving others of light drowns in the darkness of his own shadow. Will the ones who built the nightmare also drown in it? The prisoner knows the true meaning of freedom, while the guard knows only how to police this freedom. What does the jailer give up when he becomes an instrument of the state? Does the jailer remember what it means to love, to grieve, to rub the muscles of freedom, or borrow the bird's example? They cannot annihilate what we carry in our hearts and minds, this vision of an elsewhere, or the memory of a bird. How many poets and revolutionaries discovered freedom in a cell? Two, the stars seen from prison. In September 1971, the prisoners of Attica rose up, took the prison, and carved out a small space of freedom, a temporary liberated zone from which they could see the stars. Heather Ann Thompson, in A History of the Attica Uprising, writes, quote, "Despite the sense of foreboding, there were moments of levity, and for some, even a feeling of unexpected joy, as men who hadn't felt the fresh air of night for years reveled in this strange freedom. Out in the dark, music could be heard, drums, a guitar, vibes, flute, sax, that the brothers were playing. This was the lightest many of the men had felt since being processed into the maximum security facility. That night was in fact a deeply emotional time for all of them, Carlos Roche watched as tears of elation ran down the withered face of his friend Owl, an old man who had been locked up for decades. "You know," Owl said in wonderment, "I haven't seen the stars in 22 years. As Clark later described the first night of the rebellion, while there was much trepidation about what might occur next, the men in D Yard also felt wonderful because no matter what happened later on, they couldn't take this night away from us." End quote. In the cracks of the prison, something bloomed. A field of wildflowers imposed on a night sky. Blood was coming. Joy and dread mingled there, infusing the air with a powerful sense of rapture and uncertainty. What exalted frequency was discovered that night, then lost when Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered the police to put down the uprising. Blood was coming. The new world never arrived. How terrible it must have been for Du Bois to realize he had mistaken dusk for dawn, that darkness would follow and not the radiance of a new day, his people's strivings rendered crepuscular. The dream of liberation collapsed in a heap of blood-stained rubble. Blood was coming. The drumming would not last. The prisoners would be punished for daring to glimpse the stars. Will those who have constructed this hell ever wonder, what was it all for? The subordination of all life to these systems that hem us in. Why cover the sky? 3, the dialectic of dreaming. Assata Shakur, a black revolutionary who lives in exile in Cuba, writes, quote, "Dreams and reality are opposites. Action synthesizes them," end quote. Before Assata was liberated from prison, her grandmother and family came to visit her bearing a dream. "You're coming home," her grandmother said. "I don't know when it will be, but you're coming home. You're getting out of here. It won't be too long, though," she went on. "I dreamed we were in our old house in Jamaica. I was dressing you, putting your clothes on." Assata's grandmother was known for her prophetic dreams. They came when they were needed, but it was ultimately the responsibility of the recipients of the visions to make them real, not only by believing in the veracity of the prophecies, but by acting so as to give them flesh. When Assata returned to her prison cell, she could not help but dance and sing. She writes, "No amount of scientific, rational thinking could diminish the high that I felt. A tingly, giddy excitement had caught hold of me. I had gotten drunk on my family's arrogant, carefree optimism. I literally danced in my cell singing, 'Feet don't fail me now.' I sang the feet part real low, so I guess the guards must have thought I was bugging out, stomping around my cage, singing, 'Feet, feet.'" When we act in accordance with the prophetic dream, the dream comes to directly constitute reality. 4, the rhythm of revolt. Sometimes I don't know what to tell you or how to end. For some time, I've been thinking about how to convey the message of police and prison abolition to you. But I know that as a poet, it is not my job to win you over with a persuasive argument, but to impart on you a vibrational experience that is capable of awakening your desire for a new world. A couple of years ago, I saw the Black Arts Movement poet activist Sonia Sanchez speak. I was moved by the way she paused when she experienced vertigo and spontaneously started singing as a way to find her rhythm after nearly passing out. In a haiku, Sonia writes, "Without your residential breath, I lose my timing." Our bodies are not closed loops. We hold each other and keep each other in time by marching, singing, embracing, breathing. We synchronize our tempos so we can find a rhythm through which the urge to live can be expressed collectively. And in this way, we set the world in motion. In this way, poets become the timekeepers of the revolution. Thank you.
I loved how familiar that feeling of reverie that Sara Shiko talked about. I thought that I was crazy. I thought it was just me. I can be like at home having all of these ideas, you know, dancing around naked from the kitchen to the, like, yeah. That's where I do my best stuff. And how, yeah, that's where freedom reigns. I also felt like the fires of Afrofuturism were all up in that, and how much fuel I've been getting from that recently. Because when I've been speaking to you personally, we brought up about how when looking at sci-fi and speculative fiction, like how violent it feels when people of color are left out of those imaginings. And I know for myself that with reading Marge Peasy, Woman on the Edge of Time, Ursula Le Guin, Octavia Butler, that I have felt stoked up, revolutionized, and I've felt like I've drawn sustenance for moving forward from that. And yeah, basically, I know that that's where the foundation of my future is, to be honest, and how rich prison abolition will be for our artistic work.
Yeah, I mean, for me, thinking about, there is actually a Michael Hart quote that I didn't read that's in the book that's about prophetic politics, not about being about divining the future, like what is going to happen, but actually creating an opening and possibilities. And that's what I love about that quote from Asada, like action, reality and dreams are opposites, action synthesizes them. So there's a way in which, okay, now we have the vision, we have this opening, and then we have to move into it also, and find people to move into it with us as well.
And to keep writing it as well, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this, I feel like there's so many, it's great that there's such a strong, like the 20th century and prior gives us such a strong like body of, I guess particularly in writing, but not just in writing, like such a strong body of work to like help us like feel that future or feel towards it. But actually simultaneously, like what the future that's being proposed to us, I guess, like the future that the, you know, high racists of capitalism and the people who are running the states that we currently reside in are dreaming for us is like, I guess it's not the worst possible future, because maybe we already exist in the worst possible future, right? And like, how do we write like, in a way that can both abolish that future and then simultaneously I don't want to say populate, because that's kind of more people based, but like how do we create that inhabitation of that chasm that's opened up? It feels like, yeah, I have a note on my thing where it's just like decolonial poetics, and I just have this arrow that's like, how do we crash British poetry? Like, how do we abolish Britain in poetry and poetics? Which I feel is like the negative take on that, in terms of like, yeah, I don't know. I feel really, it's hard to be optimistic, but I want to keep dreaming.
Yeah. I know it's hard to be optimistic, yeah. But I think I've drawn succor from transcendental meditation, and that, particularly for me with regards to my transition, that was huge, because I had such a barrage of imagery that made me hate my queerness and hate my blackness, and it's really hard to battle through that. And I know that through the therapy that I have experienced, that I've been taught to recapture the imagination of my childhood. And so there was a calling experience where I went back to nursery and saw myself, because I was like gorgeously high feminine nursery. I worked it high. Oh my. And so it was great to go back there, and I didn't really get experience of sitting in the gorgeousness of my dreams until I'd gone back into therapy, really. And I know that in my decision to give into my transition and stuff, I had an imagining of myself which was quite mundane, and it's what I've been able to hold on dear to. I was wearing Converse, I was wearing Converse shoes and skinny jeans and some loose purple and black stripy top. And it doesn't sound that big a deal, but for me that was huge, because I think I had all of the imagery that I'd received up until that point were making me feel bad that I wasn't small, thin, tiny, white enough in order to belong in the world. And it took my imagination to give me a nice, normal, rounded vision of myself as a healthy black woman in order to get through. And then since then, meditation gives me images of my hair, like natural, moisturized, just like it's really simple things that I imagine myself in the future, which keep me growing and stuff. And I really think that if we have the time to slow down, to meditate, to go inside, to envision ourselves and others, that's what pulls me forward. Mm-hmm.
I've been reflecting quite a lot, because I just turned 30 this year. Woo!
Happy birthday.
Let's celebrate my birthday. My therapist would be really pleased. But in that, there's something about this, and I was thinking a lot about it, and I was trying to write through this in this this kind of grey pamphlet I wrote called Pound/Euro Extinctions. And there's something about the like fracturing of both like basically like being like children of color in the like growing up in the world of the colonist, or and it's like I feel like, and next to that, I guess particularly being trans, but not just being that, also this is about race so much, and like that people that it's almost like our memories are completely destroyed, and that we don't have, I don't want to say a narrative, but the like popular history and popular understanding of everything that surrounds us is completely inhabited by white, like in terms of like by whites, is a completely white space. So it's also about like how next to assimilation, white assimilation, is this complete destruction of our pasts and our beings. And so the moment you just described feels like, even as you're saying that, like it's like giving me like weird flashbacks. And yeah, I feel like there's something about how we re-piece these all together, and like how we rebuild ourselves in this world, and then like how we put ourselves forward in the world. And like for me, turning 30 has been so much about reflecting, being like, oh yeah, you know, there was like the queers were always behind me at any point, like even though everything in this culture could have made that not the case. And the entire way that my history's been told to me is like to negate that. But they were always there, right? Like it's like from like the earliest youth, the earliest photos of me that exist, the earliest reflections I've had back to me, all through those like horrendous years of my teens and et cetera, et cetera. It was always there. And so it's like the world was always there, actually.
Yeah.
We somehow were like coasting through it or whatever.
And just but currently being held hostage in the British Library. Because I find it really good, because I go to the British Library in Euston a lot, because it's the biggest like library space that I have after university and stuff. And it's really funny that when I have been researching work for my, when I've been researching my creative work and stuff, that I found so much history of pre-colonial Nigeria and pre-colonial Zimbabwe and stuff. And I had my genetics test.
Sorry, Angela. Just
it's hilarious. Yeah,
it's Nat's cat.
did that ancestry.com thing, and I didn't realize how big a deal that would be for me. Because, my dad knows that he's Zimbabwean and that we came down from Tanzania in the 15th century. And, you know, there's, I think because of the colonial narrative that there wasn't any, that there wasn't an intellectual tradition there that's really taken that away from us and stuff. And I think whenever that's said, I always think that that even though there wasn't the same level of textual record and stuff, we weren't expecting to be killed en masse. So, you know what I mean? So if, like, we hadn't been killed, we'd know a lot more, you know? And I just think, for me, it comes up in my relation to publishing a lot, because we are experiencing a freedom and liberation with online media and the production of zines and stuff. And I have made the decision finally to give up on trying to break into the publishing world, which kind of occurred because, I applied for the entry-level position at HarperCollins, which is their BAME intake, where, you know, you apply online, you do a video, and then they invite the 60 of the best. And, out of that 60, they're going to choose 2 to employ. And it was really weird, like, that process, because there were 60 of the brightest people of color in the UK in these offices, and only 2 was going to be employed, and it just felt so weird. It's like, why not all 60? You do need us all.
You should have stormed the building.
Occupation, as it goes. But I kind of gave up because I feel I just didn't want to keep on trying, and that wasn't too good for my psyche to keep on trying to break into this world which doesn't really want me and stuff. And I think, why not just publish my stuff myself and keep all the money myself?
So it's like 3:15. We should open it up a bit. Does that sound all right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There were a couple of things we were going to say at the beginning that I remembered. One was about the fact that you're all here and you're not at Dungavel, which is really cool. But the people at Dungavel, the Immigration Removal Centre, just kind of southeast of here, and which has been a key site of violence the past couple of months in particular, but for many, many, many decades at this point. But also, in answer, please feel free to ask questions and to comment. But we decided to make it an apology-free zone.
Yes.
So, please don't apologize for anything you say or do, unless, because we've been talking a lot about
how... sorries, and no, this is a really basic question, but, just don't apologize at all in talking.
Does anyone have any questions or comments? We're going to have a look. Anyone?
I'm not sorry, but it is fine if you don't want to answer this.
I guess we know.
The question is who abolishes the abolitionist? That question, that critique of abolitionism that says that it assumes an agency or a subject which who knows and is correct. I guess it's really difficult to even have this conversation because I've only really had it with or heard it said by monarchists.
Well, the prison abolition as a movement comes from black women, so that's interesting that it's only spreading through the monarchists in the UK.
We hear them say it and it's they'll say you don't need policemen, you've got identity politicians doing the policing, And I don't agree with that. Trans tax have been a few, I'm down with that, but don't these memes kind of assume a kind of knowingness, which include a conversation? And my question is, how do we have that conversation?
Okay, so it seems like there's one side of this, which is like prison abolition, what is it, where does it come from, and then like the aversion to prison abolitionist politics being circulated by arrogant anarchists. Mm-hmm. And that's not how I came to prison abolition. My point of entry was similar to Angela Davis. It was through, you know, interest in the Black Power movement. Angela Davis said, you know, she became a prison abolitionist after working for campaigns to free political prisoners. And there were, in that movement, debates about who counts as a political prisoner. So, you know, if you ask some people who are dogmatic about, you know, policing the distinction, someone like George Jackson, who was radicalized inside prison, would be just like a common prisoner and not a political prisoner. And so, you know, what happened is people, you know, realized that prisons were constitutively racist and an institution that carried out racism. And, you know, prisons, I believe that prisons and police in how they've been constituted are white supremacist and maintaining capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy, et cetera. So, like I said, it was, you know, a lot of this theorizing comes from Black women and Black feminism. And particularly there's an emphasis on, you know, imagining a world where you wouldn't need prisons. There would be, you know, different responses to harm. But also, you know, rethinking, part of that analysis was also a material analysis of like, what do people need? How do we make communities safer without relying on the police, and also, you know, thinking about a politics of care that isn't like reliant on the state, which perpetuates racist violence. So, I mean, I don't know. It's like, it's sad that there are anarchists out there giving prison abolition such a bad name, but I'll leave it at that, and if either of you want to comment on
it. I was going to say that there's always something about the kind of labor and care work that's behind all of these social movements that we're talking about, which is predominantly feminized. It's probably done by women and feminized people, including queers and trans people. Mm-hmm. And like, we were talking earlier about maybe we should just redefine queer as like being anti-police. So if Stonewall is like the archetype of queerness, like this, you have to basically be in the Stonewall riot in order to be, not to be queer, but like that is our defining terms of queerness. Now we're like, we're actually talking about a decolonial, like trans women of color, sex worker, homeless sex worker led, like, actually that, so, you know, so throwing a mortar at the police is now queerness, is like the baseline of queerness.
Yeah.
But actually that, yeah, all of this work that's happening is again like feminized labor, like who is actually doing the, like bearing the labor of the violence of prison, of the carceral state, and is that women and feminized people of color in particular, or primarily, like predominantly, not in particular, predominantly. And I just feel like, again, like this, the anarchist critique is like, all right, you just, yeah, like, no.
Such a convenient turn, though. Thank you so much. I find it funny because I always got told that I was all about, it's all identity politics now, isn't it? I found it weird because it was something foisted upon me, and I found that it just happened when I was talking about myself. It wasn't, yeah, it felt weird. So I'm like, why does this need to be summed up as something? And I'm just telling you how hard it is being me, that's all. But I also loved what Alicia Garza said in a podcast the other day. I forgot the name of it, I'm sorry. But basically talking about the fact that they don't like a certain type of identity politics, and that what they're really scared of is that in the discourses that we're currently having, that they don't center them, you know, and because it's not about, because I'm not talking about white men specifically and censor, they really want us to work on them. And, you know, they really want us to focus all our work on them. And they're scared that in the world that we've envisaged that they don't want to be replaced. I really think what they were chanting in Charlottesville is really important. You will not replace us. You will not replace us. I don't have any desire to replace anyone. They're scared that we're going to start having sex with them. You know that, you know, you've already stopped cooking, and you know, and they're scared because their vision of a world is one in which you dominate and you win and you kill, and they are scared that we are as bloodthirsty and desperate for erasure as they have been, and they don't understand that we don't have those same homicidal, genocidal intentions. And that really and truly, all we want to do is lie around, write poetry, and eat well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Oh my God.
Mm. Oh yeah, and on the sex part, obviously, lots of. Yeah, it's just like finally it'll be consent and like, yeah, much less violence, which is as dire as this time that we're going through is, it's fucking wonderful. This purge that we're going through and the reflection and the fact that there's so many women writers right now who are it's wonderful. The courage, the bravery, the self-reflection, the awareness. I also feel like we have to get used to this and the fact that there's going to be waves of it, you know, because there's people who are being abused now who are going to be writing about it in the future, and that this is part of our healing process and moving into the future, that this will keep happening until it stops, and I think it's a necessary part of our progression. Mm. More questions?
There's oh, one we have one minute. Back,
yeah.
Thank you so much. That was amazing. My question is about in your writing, how you navigate this anticipatory consciousness that you all express so beautifully, whether that's an Afrofuturist consciousness, abolitionist consciousness, queer consciousness. How you navigate the tension between that and the reality of the world that we, you know, unfortunately are living in. So this tension between writing for the world you want and the world that you're in. Because I think sometimes it's a question of audience, you know, whether it's this issue of writing, you know, being forced to write very basic pieces again and again, or in more complex ways, the assumptions about, to what extent you can sort of invoke a world that's not there, and to what extent you have to address the conditions of the present.
I can just talk about what I did in my book because, oh my God, writing this book was so depressing because you just realize how fucked things are all the way down. Uh-huh. And
all the way up too, right?
Yeah, like, right. In every single direction, it's fucked. But for me, I found that I basically had to switch modes and move between different ways of thinking and writing. And I mean, it wasn't even, you know, so I would just, you know, have enough hope to keep on going or something like that. It was like, I just can't drop this, you know, total bleakness without trying to, you know, move reality in a different direction. So for me, it was like when I realized when I had the manuscript that it was lacking something, which was, you know, what I call the prison abolitionist imagination. And so, yeah, it was like, it is like a balancing act, like trying to figure out like, okay, when you're writing the utter despair and fucked upness, how do you just not reproduce that? How do you just not make, you know, people walk away from it feeling like, well, there's nothing to be done. It's totally fucked. So, yeah, I had to figure out a way to temper that.
Yeah, I have the same problem in writing about, I had it recently, I was writing about online trolls and how, like, so, cause it's weird, cause I think I really like the trolls underneath some of my articles, and you can, you know, I don't necessarily read them all, but I'm like, it's very angry, and I find that really gorgeous, but at the same time, I know I need humour in my work. I really need that just to weave in and out and to keep, you know, I really don't want anyone to leave my writing feed just drowning in their despair. There isn't that, the tension that you spoke about, it's not so much a tension, it's actually like, that's the wind. Do you know what I mean? So it's that prison abolition, it's that Afrofuture that ushers people forward and stuff. Of course you deal in the reality, of course you ground it, and you let people know that their existence, you see their existence and you know what they're going through, but you have to give them something to keep on going and stuff. And so you need to give them, put the wind in their sails with the writing, I feel.
I feel like for me it's always come back to writing and like trying to write through these spaces, trying to write through the bleakness, be that like trying to intellectualize and understand what the state of the world is, which is like my PhD that I've been writing for 6 years, right? And then next to that is like literally like kind of stealing time from that world. So like one, like I've had so many office jobs and you're just like, okay, so here I am. And then you're like, how do you write through these spaces? And then finding people to communicate, like to bring that work into communication with each other, that knowing that there are like hundreds of, there are like thousands of people out there who care about some of the things that you care about or have a common ground in that. And like, how do you find them? And sometimes it's the joy of social media, right? We can just be at work. If you have a lax enough job where you can go on the internet, it's like, friend, save me from the boredom of employment. But I guess that's partly why, why I write, like, to try and write through that world to come out of it the other side alive. And it's necessity as well, right? It's like, I can think back and reflect on the however many years past. I've been thinking quite a lot about the past like 7 years in particular, and like how much crap there was, and like even when you thought you're doing well, actually you weren't doing as well as you could have been, and like that's like so much of that is structural. At least I like to have built a structural understanding of that gives me some strength. But then this is like the pleasure and the laughter and the need for the goodness and the joy. You can keep finding that. You just have to find the people that you can share that with, and. Often that can be textual as well, right? It doesn't have to be IRL. Although IRL really helps. I was doing a workshop yesterday, I was saying like, sleepovers, have some sleepovers, invite your friends around, have cooked dinner. Like, full nominism, right?
That was the social form that my feminist reading group took. We just started having sleepovers after a reading group, and then we would just like paint our nails and do stick and poke tattoos and talk politics. So I am a big fan of the sleepover as a social form.
Because we're coming out of time, can we talk about the need for you guys to share our work? I love people following. Follow me everywhere. it goes, particularly Twitter, because Twitter is so hard as it goes. But follow me. Please share our work. We really deserve it. And as it goes, that's what I'd like to end on. Good.
I invite you to tweet your dreams at me.
Well, you've got to give your handles though, right?
Yeah, sure. So I'm at Kuchengcheng, Kuchengcheng. And then just Kuchenga on everything else, like Facebook and Instagram and stuff,
I'm at Loneberry Wang, LoneberryWang. That's too long as a Twitter
name. Yeah, I know, but we have like ethnic names, so we don't have to, you have to think of it creatively.
I'm quite into Instagram at the moment. I'm quite enjoying this visual. So my Instagram is at full underscore nominism, mm-hmm. which is like the food communism, right? Nominism. If you remove the underscore, you have my Twitter handle. So yeah. It's full nominism. But I also kind of like, I'm struggling with Twitter a bit sometimes. It's a bit like mm-hmm. too much of a barrage. Mm-hmm. I'm also on Facebook. I don't know. Facebook still like feels like life. Like so much of life is just documented on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so life is there and poems and yeah. Yeah.
Standard.
Thank you all for coming.
You guys have been so lovely. Thank you.
Do you need to do an announcement? Oh.